This is a program belonging to the Haddenham Farmland Museum Sound Archive and was edited and in some cases recorded at the Lanehead Studio, which is also in Haddenham. Well, it's a beautiful afternoon. We're in a very pleasant garden in the heart of East Anglia, and even though it is the last day of September, we're enjoying some an Indian summer. And what better day or what better conditions could there be for going out on a picnic and enjoying cakes and sandwiches and all the goodness and the good fillings that go into the sandwiches, including butter, which brings us very nicely into what this program is about, and cheese as well. We're also going to be discussing cheese with Jean Richards. First of all, hello, Jean, and welcome. Thank you very much for allowing us to come into your garden this afternoon.
Well, it's nice to see you. I hope I'll be able to give you some information which is of interest to your listeners.
Now, the art of butter making, I must start, so my listeners know, I'm completely ignorant about this fact. I have a few aces up my sleeve, if you can say. But you're the person who knows all about it. When did you first come across the art? Was it through childhood, watching others?
Yes, well, my grandfather, when I was a child, had a country house, and as was common in those days, they had their own house cows. And prior to the last war, it was the servants who made the butter. But of course, with the coming of the war, it became our responsibility, and so week after week I got involved with churning and preparing the butter for the household.
And that in itself would be done by hand, would it?
Oh yes, entirely. And of course, when I was a very small child, the cream for the butter was prepared by the milk being brought into the dairy each day, and the milk was then poured into very large, well, not large, but wide, shallow pans, about 4 feet across, mm-hmm. and it was left to stand in those pans overnight. And then on the following day, a member of the household, whoever it was who was responsible for making butter, would skim it. And that was quite a skilled job, because you wanted to get all the cream without wasting it, mm-hmm. and yet not to include any milk, because that made making the butter more difficult. Mm. So that was a very traditional way of making butter, from the point of view of how you got your cream to make the butter with. Just before the war, my grandfather bought a centrifugal separator, which did the job and did it much more effectively and efficiently. And that meant bringing the milk in from the milking every day and passing it through the separator while it was still warm. It was essential for it to be separated at the right heat. And I don't know whether people have seen a separator, but there were several different varieties, but the most common one had a large bowl on the top. Below that bowl were two shallow pans with what I suppose you could call them spouts. And within the centre of these pans were a series of small plates which whizzed around at very high speed. And out of the top of the spout came the cream, which you kept for the butter making, and out of the bottom came the separated milk, which in our household was used to feed the pigs.
And this is, I mean, you used to drink the milk before it was pasteurised and things.
Oh, like yes, there's no question of pasteurising it.
What would happen if you, because you said about you didn't want the inclusion of milk into the butter making process. What would happen if there was milk there?
Oh, it doesn't upset the butter making process, and in fact I believe that further back in time, milk was actually churned, whole milk was churned, but the more consistent the cream is, the easier it is to make it into butter. And if it varies in thickness, it's more difficult for the butter to come.
So we've come to the process where you separated the milk or the cream from the milk. What happened then? What was the next process?
Well, having separated the cream, you then collected the cream from several days. And usually that was collected in a deep, rather thick earthenware pot. An open pot with just a muslin cover put over it to keep it clean. And according to the time of year, 2, 3, 4 days milk was separated, the cream collected, and then the churning undertaken after that.
That in itself, for the churning, you would have to... How long would that take?
Well,
that's
a very difficult question. Because if everything went right, the whole process of churning the cream could be completed in about half an hour. You start... there were several different types of churn, but the commonest was what's known as the end-over-end churn, which is a churn which is made in the shape of a small beer barrel. And which has a lid which you lift off one end, and in that lid is a small glass window. There is also the equivalent of a pressure valve in that lid. Now, you took the lid off, you put the cream in, and you screwed the lid down again. You then began to churn the cream by turning it over and over at a very regular speed. And if everything was going right, in about 10 minutes to quarter of an hour, the noise of the churning changed. And it began to slurp. And that was when you said that the cream was breaking. And you watched through the little window to see what the condition was inside the churn. When you heard the change of note, you then began to watch very carefully, because that was when things were beginning to happen. Incidentally, I forgot to say that when you first begin to churning, you would press on the valve to let the gas out, because in churning the cream, you produced a certain amount of gas. I don't know what gas it is, but anyhow, you had to let it out.
I see. And this art of being in tune with what was going on in the churn, I mean, did you pick that up yourself? Was that taught to you?
Oh, well, I mean, if you lived in a house where they made butter regularly week after, obviously if you were a small child, you were asked to hang on, give it a few turns while I go and put the kettle on, or something like that. And you got attuned to it. You could tell by the note in the churn what was happening.
Was it very strenuous turning that?
Well, it wasn't if everything went right, and it wasn't awfully strenuous if you know, didn't have... hadn't got a very big churn and you hadn't got a very full churn. But there were occasions when things went wrong and you could be churning on and on and on, and then it got very tiring and very tedious, and you felt it were never going to come.
What brought that about then?
Well, one of the commonest reasons, I think, was due to the cream being at the wrong temperature. We always had, in latter years, a cream thermometer, which was a great big thermometer about, I suppose, 16 or 18 inches long, which you dropped into the cream, and it was loaded so that it stayed upright in the cream. And it's very important to get the cream at the right temperature, neither too cold nor too hot. But certainly before we had the thermometer, sometimes it was too cold or it was too hot. And when that happened, things didn't go according to plan. They could carry on for a long time without it beginning to break. And that was the crucial moment. Once it broke, you were home and dry. I can remember towards the latter part of my experience of making butter when, on occasions, if the weather was very hot, we used to put ice in it to get the temperature down. But prior to that, in hot weather, cold water very often was used.
So it would be more difficult to make it in the hot summer, would it?
Could be, yes, but it could be quite difficult even in very cold weather as well, for the opposite reason.
So we've now reached to the stage where you've heard the right note, if we can say that. What happened then?
Well, then, as I say, you began to watch the glass. And after a time, little tiny grains, yellow grains, would appear on the glass. And then you dropped the speed of the churning and churned it quite gently, just to let those granules gather together and let the buttermilk come out. It was important not to let the stage go on too long. But when you've got granules about the size of a piece of grain, that was the time when you stopped. And there was a bung at the bottom of the churn. You took the bung out and you drew off the buttermilk.
I see.
Not quite all of it, otherwise you would have lost some of your granules, but the bulk of the buttermilk.
What did you do with the buttermilk?
Well, it was either drunk, because a lot of people like buttermilk, and in fact people used to ask us to keep it for them, especially during the war when it was not easy to get. Or like the skim milk, it was given to the pigs.
Yes. Or one lady I was talking to, she gives it to her cats. Did it have a strong taste, a funny taste?
Oh, no. No, it's just very slightly slightly sour and slightly tart, you know. Mm. A little bit like a yoghurt flavour in many ways.
So we know what we did with the buttermilk, what you did with the buttermilk. You now have the granules in the churn. What was the next process?
Right. Now, you then churned it gently so that it clumped together a bit more. Mm-hmm. And then you started washing it. You poured in clean water into the churn and vigorously churned it to wash out all the remaining buttermilk. And you drew off that first lot of water, and you then added a second lot of water, and you continued until the water was absolutely clear. Usually two washings were enough. Mm-hmm. But when you drew off the water, it should be absolutely clear so that there's no buttermilk remaining in it, because if the buttermilk stays in the butter then goes slightly rancidy tasting. It doesn't stay fresh and nice.
So you've got to that process. It's very, very involved, isn't it?
Well, it isn't really. It sounds much more complicated than in fact it is. I'm trying to describe it in detail for people who haven't had no experience of it. But actually, it's really, you know, it's quite a simple sequence. Mm.
And then when the granules had formed, you'd washed it twice.
That's right. Well, we then would take it out of the churn. It's now in a nice big lump. Thump, thump as you turn the churn over. Mm. And we would take it out and we would work in the butter. The salt.
Ah, yes.
Into the butter. Because you don't have to put salt in butter. It's a matter of choice, but in those days we rather liked salt butter. And we always worked the salt into the butter.
Because they make a great store of it on the advertisements. No names mentioned, but if it's slightly salted, they think that there's some greatness, or that adds something to the butter.
Yes, well, this is, partly fashion, partly choice. In those days, we rather liked slightly salty butter, and certainly in our household, the butter was always salted. Mm. That was worked into the butter with Scotch hands. Now, those are little flat, square utensils, rather like... the best description I can give to you is that they're like two miniature badminton bats that are square, only instead of being round. And the surface of each of those is grooved. and you can beat hell out of the butter with them. We always made our butter on a marble slab mm-hmm. Because it was nice and cool. But to actually, first of all, get the salt into the butter, you kneaded it with the Scotch hands. Mm. Then you belted the butter hard to get the water out of it, because you didn't want any water remaining within the butter. No. And then, having done that with the mass of the butter, you then chopped it up into bits and measured into 1/2 pounds or whatever weight of butter you wanted.
What about the length of time it would keep? Was there any difference with the butter you buy today? I mean, did you have fridges or...?
Well, in the country in those days, nearly every farmhouse and country house had dairy, even before the days of fridges. And certainly in my grandfather's house, there were two very large slate slabs, which would cost a fortune nowadays, on which the skimming pans stood, on which butter was stored, and the temperature in that room, the dairy was always built on the north side of a house mm-hmm. Or a farmhouse, and the temperature was kept as low as possible through natural means. And it was very normal for people who'd got a dairy to keep their to have a meat safe also within yes, the dairy to keep their meat in there as well.
Oh, here at the church, huh? That proves that we are outside. We don't need the proof. Now, how many pints of milk do you reckon it would take to make, shall we say, 1/2 pound or 1 pound of butter?
From memory, I think it takes a quart of cream, not milk, quart of cream to make 1 pound of butter. That's from memory. I think that's right.
And the quart of cream would come from how many pints of
Well, that would depend on varying factors, of course, because if, for instance, if you've got Jersey cows, you get a higher butter fat content in your milk. Mm. And it depends on the time of year and the sort of grazing. But I would think, I'm not at all sure, you know, what it would be, between 2 and 3 gallons of milk to the quart of cream, I should think.
Really, as much as that. Mm.
But I'm not firm on that one at all. I may be talking through the top of my head.
Well, from what little knowledge I have gleaned for this interview, I think you're somewhere right in yeah. that. You're not far short, or probably even. There was even more. Anyway, what is the mainstay of the rural area? I mean, because you weren't actually, we weren't talking in East Anglia, but you were born or you lived
yes,
in...
Yes, I come from Shropshire, of course, which in the North Shropshire area, going towards the Cheshire Plain, is, of course, a dairying country. Mm. And as you go nearer to Cheshire, it is more and more into dairying. And I learnt to make Cheshire cheese actually in Shropshire at a farm outside Whitchurch in Shropshire mm-hmm. because that's going into the Cheshire Dairy Plain area.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard some people say, today you've spoken about the process of churning it by hand and separating the butter from the buttermilk. Today they do it by electricity, which is rather
yes.
cheating. But if it isn't, especially people around in this area, if they sell it off to friends or neighbours and what have you, if it isn't the right colour, they tend to use carrot juice or even a little drop of orange juice, which must come as a great surprise to many people.
Well, prettying things up for the market is not new.
No.
And at certain times of the year, there's not much colour in the cream. It depends on the grazing. It depends on what sort of food the cattle are getting. Mm-hmm. And I can understand that might very well have happened, that if you got a very white-looking butter, because for some reason the cattle had not been eating food which coloured the cream well, it would be a very easy way to make it more marketable, just to add a little colouring.
Mm.
In exactly the same way as there are two sorts of Cheshire cheese, there is the red cheese and the white, and they are actually absolutely identical, except that one has got colouring in and the other hasn't.
Mm. Because I just read recently in the paper, and some of our listeners won't know about this, but there are orange juices on the market, you can buy them, and in fact they're only carrot juice with a flavouring that has nothing to do with oranges at all, but actually tastes like orange. But still, this is a little thing I put in. What do you make it still today?
Oh no, I think very few people make farmhouse butter nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course you've got to have the sauce, haven't you?
Well indeed, yes. Mm. And I mean, the regulations now about pasteurisation are quite different, and I've had nothing to do with the dairy industry for the last 20 years or so, but I had a small dairy farm in North Wales some years ago, and I was selling natural cream, if I can put it that way, direct to the public, unpasteurised, and there were no problems about it. I wouldn't be allowed to do that nowadays.
No. Now, hand on the heart time now. The butter you made and the butter I can go and pick up in the supermarket, which tasted the better?
I really can't say. I mean, sometimes our butter tasted horrible.
This is a revelation.
Well, I don't know if you've ever had the misfortune of drinking milk from cows that have eaten wild garlic, but I can tell you it's a very interesting experience. And there is nothing nastier than either cream or butter, where the cattle have had their noses into a bit of wild garlic. You can imagine, garlic-flavoured butter is quite revolting.
Yes.
And there's nothing you can do if you get a taint in butter to get rid of it.
Mm. What about selling it to the French? I mean, would they appreciate it?
I don't think so, no. And there are numbers of plants which can taint.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, if cattle get mastitis,
mm-hmm.
that will taint the cream, it will cause trouble and may make the butter taste slightly nasty.
Mm-hmm. So there are all these pointers to look out for.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I mean, obviously, you've explained how you made the butter, the process, but I mean it was a very long process, because as you started to say at the beginning of this interview, you first of all had to separate the cream. Would have this gone on all day, you know what I mean, separating the cream, putting it out, and then sifting it and what have you, and then of course churning the butter.
Yes.
Well,
you've got to realise that with cows you're on a 7-day rotation. There's no unplugging them for the seventh day.
No.
So your routine is the cows are milked in the morning, the milk is brought in and dealt with in the morning, either by being put in the skim pans or being put through the separator. The same happens in the afternoon for the second milking. That goes on for as long as you wish to continue. You may have a big flush of milk, so that you're churning every 2 or 3 days.
Mm.
On the other hand, you may have much less milk, less cream, and it's you're only going through that process once in 4 or 5 days.
I see. Now, you also used to make cheese. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of making that?
Well, I went to learn how to make Cheshire cheese at one of the old, one of the few remaining farms that was still making farmhouse cheese immediately after the war, because I wanted to learn how to make it. And that, I can't give you all the temperatures and things because I can't remember them, but that's quite a long process too. There we had a herd of about 80 cows on that farm, and we made cheese every day of the week. Mm. The cheese making, the principal and the most important piece of equipment is a large vat which is double-sided. Now the milk is poured into the vat, and steam is fed in between the two sides of the vat to warm it up. You have to get the milk to exactly the right temperature. You then pour in the starter, which begins the fermentation process.
What is that, maybe?
That is what you've saved from the previous day.
I see, yeah.
So anybody who's made yogurt knows that you have to have a starter, which is the culture.
Oh, I see, yeah.
To get the right bacteria moving in that batch of milk. And you have to save your starter under very, very careful hygienic conditions, yeah. So it doesn't get contaminated in any way.
So it's clean bacteria, then, if it...
That's right, yes. Yeah. And you've got to introduce your starter in order to get the process of the cheese making going. The milk is at the right temperature, the starter is introduced, and then you wait. Mm-hmm. And it turns into, for Cheshire cheese, every cheese varies slightly according to what the process is, but for Cheshire cheese, you have what is like a junket forms inside the vat. Mm. And when that is at the right stage, which you can tell, the experienced cheesemakers can tell by just putting their fingers on the top of the junket and just feeling it, then you introduce the cutting knives. And these are things like... I can only describe them as being like those scraper mats that you have outside your front door, which are made of long, flat rods of metal.
Yeah, I know the kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, the cutting knife is like a slice of your scraper mat with a handle, and it goes down, it's about 2 foot long, and it goes down into the vat, and then you walk from one end of the vat to the other, backwards and forwards. And you cut the curd into thin strips. Mm-hmm. You then do it across the vat. Mm-hmm. And so that you've then got your curd in little blocks throughout the vat. That is then kept at the right temperature while it sheds the whey.
It curds in whey, as
yes,
you know.
That's right. That's where it comes from. And many people don't understand that. So you then allow the whey to break away from the curd. Mm. And at the right stage, the curd is, the whey is drawn off. And you said, what happens to the buttermilk? What happens to the whey is it's fed to the pigs. Because the old farmhouse cheese making was almost always linked to a pig enterprise, because whey is absolutely super stuff. The pigs do wonderfully well on it.
Really?
Yeah. If they are fed with whey mixed with some other forms of food stuff, you know, they really produce beautiful pork. Mm. So, your curd is a sort of leathery white mess at the bottom of your vat. And it's at this stage that you break it up, and then you with your hand, and then you leave it to prove for a little time. I can't remember the time scale now, because it's so many years since I did it. And then you have to take the curd and put it through a mill.
Yeah.
Now that's like a parsley mill that you have in your kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's but on a very much larger scale. And of course in a commercial cheese making factory, everything motorized, but in the old farmhouse cheese making, you did it by hand, and there was a hopper at the top of the mill. Mm-hmm. You fed the curd into the hopper, you turned the handle, and the curd came down and it was in little bits then, small pieces about the size of a two-penny piece,
mm-hmm.
present-day two-penny yeah. piece. That then had to be salted
mm-hmm.
and mixed with the salt, and you put it at that stage, when you'd mixed it with the salt, you packed it into the cheese case. I can't remember the proper term for it, but it's...